Your time and expertise are valuable, making focus one of the most important resources to have at work. These days, professionals spend nearly half the work week on written communication, and it can be difficult to stay on task with all the emails and documents you have to get through. With Grammarly as your AI writing partner, you can stay focused and quickly get through your work with relevant, real-time suggestions wherever you write. It works across 500,000 apps and websites, so it can help with everything, from brainstorming presentation ideas to sounding more confident and persuasive in emails and reports. For 15 years, Grammarly has offered best-in-class communication support and enterprise-grade security on a business model that doesn't sell your data. 93% of professionals report that Grammarly helps them get more work done. Download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast.
The $99 Cedar Point Gold Pass is back for a limited time. Get unlimited visits for the rest of this year and all of 2025, including unlimited hollow weekends and free parking. Don't wait, because the price goes up on September 3rd. Get your 2025 Gold Pass and start planning your visit at cedarpoint.com.
It's the Britflix.com podcast. Welcome to the Britflix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today I've got to meet Gabe Turner. Hello, Gabe.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going very well. It's going very well. Lack of sleep, but, you know, I think I'll survive. So, do you want to tell us what the film is we're going to talk about and your role on that film first?
So, the film is The Governors.
Yeah.
And my role was, I was the writer and the director of the film.
Brilliant. That puts you in a good bracket of knowledge for what we're going to do in this podcast. So, first off, do you want to give us a brief synopsis of what The Governors is about?
Yeah, I suppose The Governors is about the coming together of two very different groups, an older group and a younger group. At its core, really, it's a film about fathers and sons and relationships and where to apportion blame and whose fault is what, as it were. But it really centres around these two gangs, a gang that used to rule the streets in a certain area 20, 30 years ago, yeah, and a new gang that are coming up now of sort of 18, 19-year-olds that are terrifying the local estate. And after a certain period of time, they start going looking for the old guys, and by some of their actions, they end up waking the beast, and the old guys get back together, and they have a showdown at the end between the two.
Indeed, indeed. And I was lucky enough to go and see it at one of the preview screenings a couple of weeks back, and it's an excellent film. So, congratulations.
Thank you.
What compelled you to write the script for Governors?
Well, I think I'd spoken with Metrodome, who were the distributors, yeah, and they were kind of fascinated by this story that had come out during the London riots that was essentially about, somewhere in South London, mm-hmm, but there was a group of guys that had taken to the streets to protect their local town centre, yeah, from some of the looting that was going on, and basically said, you're not going to march on our patch, as it were. And so from that kind of, see, this idea of like ex-football hooligans that used to be involved in the gang and were kind of straight now and weren't really getting involved so much, but still, it was all still there. And the anger, I suppose, was bubbling under the surface. So it kind of manifested itself in this environment when the kids were kind of trying to take over.
Yeah.
And that kind of seed of an idea led to us trying to develop a more complicated story that involved, as I said, involved fathers and sons, and how the landscape has changed over the last 20, 30 years. What I wasn't trying to do was kind of glamorize the olden days and be like, well, they were kind of all right because there were slightly more rules or more of a framework. I was more trying to make the comment that violence kind of ends or leads you down a path that isn't great, no matter when it existed, as it were. So even at 20, 30 years ago or now, today, if you immerse yourself in a violent sort of style of life, some way or another, it's going to end up ending badly, probably.
And it definitely it touches on the idea of whether or not you, I mean, because you get people like almost 20 years out of retirement, it's like whether or not it ever leaves you.
Yeah, well, I think it's very like you can definitely like start again in life, and get second chances and move on and everything. But I think sometimes that your past can catch up with you. And I think that this was just, yeah, it was about that kind of deeply ingrained anger that lives inside. And as you say, sometimes you can't shake that off ever.
Indeed. And then in the writing stage of that, then, like you say, it's much more complicated than just simply about two generations having a bit of a dust up. It is about fathers and their sons. What would be for you some of the hardest challenges to resolve in the storytelling? Where were you most challenged?
Well, it's always because my background's in documentary, so the story's always written for me, and it's just about me eking that story out and trying to find the best angle to tell it or the most interesting things about it. So what I found it was a challenge was I was essentially making everything up, and when you're making everything up, it's hard to gauge whether it's realistic or unrealistic, or you know, whether it's preposterous or totally legitimate when you're kind of investigating various twists and turns to keep your audience interested. Mm. So, yeah, I kind of felt like that was the biggest challenge, was to be like, can this link with that? Can we do this? Can we do that? Is it too much? Is it not enough? Are the stakes high enough? Are they too low? You know, those kind of questions I found challenging, basically because my background was dealing with facts, you know, because I come from a documentary background where it's all there. Mm. You don't have to make it up at all.
What do you think you brought, you were able to bring from documentaries then to help you with this?
Well, I think I was prepared to be more creative in the edit, because I'm used to trying stuff out in the edit as you do on documentaries. With fiction, it's slightly more organized prior to the edit. So there's maybe a tendency to not try so much in the edit, but we kind of approached the edit in the same kind of way we would with a documentary, which was there were no real rules to what goes where and how and try stuff out, and you might get something better than was on the script.
So is that sort of the difference between, like, with the script, this I suppose there's intent with every scene you write, whereas if you go in the edit with a documentary, you might find the story.
Yeah, yes, you've always got sort of an idea of where you're going to take the story, but I would say that in a documentary, you write the story in the edit, whereas in the fiction, you write the story before you shoot.
Yeah.
So it's just sort of two different stages, really, and they're just as creative and interesting as each other, but they are quite different.
And in that kind of pre-production stage, and once you've got the script written out, as it were, ready to go, what were the aspects of the shoot that's, you know, because obviously when we're making films, money doesn't grow on trees.
Yeah.
So things, you know, things have been budgeted for. What aspects of the shoot seemed like insurmountable, and then how did you break through those?
Well, I couldn't work out for the life of me how I was going to do the scene in the football stadium.
Right.
Because I didn't think, A, any football stadium would let us do it inside, and B, how do you fake the noise and the crowd of a full stadium when, if you are going to get a stadium, it's going to be completely empty.
Yeah.
And we didn't have 40,000 extras. So it was like how I couldn't really understand how I was going to make that work. And then I also think mostly was the scene at the end where there's a massive fight between the two of them.
Mm.
And, you know, you grow up watching films like Gladiator and stuff, and it's like amazing. Do you know what I mean? You see some amazing stuff. And like I've seen so many, like I remember watching 300 and thinking it was just so incredibly shot, the way the people came together and fought. And I thought, like, even though this is a far smaller scale, people in the cinema are used to seeing fighting or like battle scenes really, really advanced.
Mm.
So you can't really shortchange them. You can't give them something and go, well, we didn't have as much budget because they don't care. So I was kind of, it was kind of daunting approaching those 2 days and thinking I've got to, you know, it's got to match up to any fight scene in any film. It doesn't matter that you've got no money. You know, that's not going to be an excuse. So that was quite daunting. But I think in the end, it looks really good, that particular scene.
Do you want to give us any sort of any creative ideas you came up with then to achieve the sort of, I guess, higher production value results than you maybe had at your fingertips?
Say that again, sorry?
Do you want to give us an example of maybe some of the creative ideas you come up with to start to create those higher production values than maybe your budget should allow?
It's kind of you kind of shoot it differently to make sure that, so like It's really how you compose the shots.
Okay.
So you you might want a 360 set, but you've actually got a very, very small area that we're shooting into because you can't afford to build this 360 set. So therefore you're going to shoot it very differently. I don't think there were any particular tricks of trying to make it look bigger. I think sound is massive, obviously.
Okay.
So for example, in the stadium, like the crowd noise, and we recorded a tannoy loads and loads of sound design to try and make it feel busier, which I think works.
No, definitely.
So I suppose sound really helps. But yeah, no, I wouldn't say we tried anything particularly spectacular in terms of making it look way more expensive than it actually was, or that we had much more tools to play with than we actually did.
And who were your key collaborators on sort of? So it's like, say, let's say choreographing the fight scene. Who were the people you were collaborating with?
We had a few fight choreographers. We had a guy called Jude, a guy called Dom. One of the things that was really helpful is we had a couple of sort of stuntmen take the punches. They looked, they knew how to take them to look realistic. And those guys were quite helpful whenever we did the fights. But really, my main collaborator was James Friend, who's the DOP, who was sort of had a bit more experience than I did in shooting action. So we discussed it quite a lot about how we were going to approach it. But I always kind of felt like, there's one scene in there which I was really happy with, where it's kind of a Steadicam shot when Mitch, the protagonist, goes to Adam's house. And outside there's a bunch of sort of gangsters looking after the property. So when he goes to the door, he has to sort of beat his way through them. Yeah. And I'd always sort of been very keen to shoot without cutting. So without sort of like flipping the angles and trying to do sort of a Steadicam shot that where just the way we blocked it masked all of the punches, as it were.
Yeah.
And so instead of doing loads of different angles of that one scene, I just did one shot and I just did it loads and loads and loads of times to see if I could make it work without any mistakes. And then I felt like, because there wasn't a cut in there and the Steadicam sort of glides through the space, that it would look more real and tried to sort of make it feel more epic, and I think it kind of worked, or at least I hope it did.
Well, it forces us, the audience, to watch what's going on. You're not allowed a breather with the edit can sometimes let you do.
Yeah, exactly.
So casting the film, as well as the story being about different generations, this is tenuous, so bear with me. You've got two pop stars in your cast.
David Essex and Harley.
You've got David Essex from one generation, and obviously you've got Harley Sylvester, Arthur Rizzlekicks. Obviously, the film's not important in terms of casting them, but just thinking about casting, and obviously David has got a history of that went from being a pop singer to working in film and TV. What was your logic in choosing Harley then, taking him from that kind of?
Well, Harley I'd known for a while.
Okay.
And we'd actually spoken about doing a film before. I knew that his background at Brit School was as an actor, and that was kind of one of his burning passions, was to be in a film. So we'd kind of spoken about it before. We'd done some TV work together, and we'd spoken about it before. And when I wrote the role, I wasn't convinced that he would be able to do this role because it was really dark. And
yeah, it's quite a nasty piece of work.
He's a really lovely guy.
Which isn't really him.
Exactly. He's just a really friendly, lovely guy. So yeah. I wasn't necessarily thinking of him, but I sent him the script because he's kind of a friend. I want to know his opinion.
Yeah.
And he was like, I want to do it. So I thought, well, it's kind of interesting because I do think he's a talented actor. So I should definitely meet with him and let's sort of work it through and see if it's a possibility. And then when he first read, although he obviously looked quite, he didn't look right at the time because we hadn't done any makeup and he had long hair and everything else. His acting was really good and the emotion that needed to come through with that character was coming through. So I felt like that was the most important thing. And then in terms of, making him look more threatening, that was really a job for us. We shaved his head and we put a scar on him. We worked a lot about how he held himself physically and how he walked around. And those things are things you can work on. But whether someone can or can't get the emotion of the character across is something which is harder to work on, and he had that straight away. So it made me confident that he could do it.
Yeah, no, from my point of view, he was unrecognizable once the film started. As you see the name as the credit, then the film starts and you almost forget immediately.
Yeah.
I mean, he's proper nasty, isn't he?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
But I must admit, David Essex is in my favourite bit of the film, and this wouldn't spoil it. It's not a massive part of the film, but it did. I think it's kind of a nice sort of light-hearted way to sort of start that bridge between these people from 20 years ago and these people from sort of in the present, as it were, when he lamps the guy.
Yeah. Well, I'd actually seen that scene was from, you know, you get loads of different inspirations across different other films that you've watched or... I don't know, stuff that you've seen and not. That actually, the inspiration for that was that it came from a clip I'd seen online of an ex-vet, army veteran who, I don't know where he was living, but sort of provincial England. And someone was going around to his house, some kid was going around to his house and shouting in his face and saying, go on, hit me, go on, mate, hit me. And, you know, like throwing his rubbish bin around in the front lawn and basically just being really, really arrogant, really down. The guy is desperately trying not to hit him. You can see that this guy's a trained fighter. And yeah, eventually it bubbles over and this guy knocks him out with one punch. And I'd seen that video. My friends had sent it to me online. Like, and we'd all been really amused by it and satisfied by it. And I just thought that that would be a really good scene where in the cinema you'd get people being really excited to see it. And when we had the premiere, actually, there were people cheering when he did it, David Essex. And I think when he read the role, he was very keen to play, to do that scene. He really liked that scene and he was really up for doing it.
And in a way, it does reflect a genuine, I guess, kind of reactionary mood that does exist. It's not like it's sort of fantasy. There are people that think that if I just do this, it will solve the problem.
Yeah, basically, yeah. I think that, well, I think that people don't, you know, I'm someone who always felt to a degree like they're, you know, your actions have consequences, and I've never been someone who's been loose in that kind of environment where you think, well, I'll just knock him out and that'll end it, because I've always thought, well, if you beat someone up or you humiliate someone, they're just going to come back stronger. It doesn't solve the problem. So yeah, I it surprises me that people think that that's a way of dealing with stuff, but you know, they do, don't they?
And obviously the film plays out and has very tragic consequences as a result of that. But yeah, I can see how that would be a kind of yes moment for an audience, but then obviously the sort of moral of the tale is that isn't a yes moment in a way.
So sorry, you I lost you for a second there. So that one sec.
I was just saying that I can see how that moment can be sort of punch the air moment for the audience, but in fact, the tragedy that follows is really the moral of the tale. The moral in the tale,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. End. Well, that's exactly it. And it's not so much frustrating, because you want your films to have to resonate with people and them to have different reactions about what it's about and so on and so forth and what it means. But I suppose it did frustrate me a little bit that some people kind of got the idea that I was glamorizing violence, whereas very, very much my feeling across the whole thing was not to glamorize violence in any way, but really to undermine it.
Yeah, I think it's almost like it's that moment is a trick, really, isn't it? In that moment, it is glamorizing violence, not you purposefully, but the fact that that's something that we'd all like to do because we think that would solve problems, but what happens subsequently shows...
Well, that's the thing, yeah. It's supposed to leave you when you leave the cinema thinking the answer is definitely not violence. The answer is to find other ways of dealing with situations. But yeah, there are certainly points in there that allow you to... Sorry, there are certainly points in there that allow you to enjoy someone getting a smack.
Exactly.
Someone who needs a smack getting a smack.
I'd never seen... Doug Allen before, and I thought he was a cracking leading man.
He's an amazing leading man. Yeah, I was amazed he hasn't done more stuff. I think he's so good looking.
Yeah, that's what I was.
And
saying.
I think, and he's really stoic. I think the interesting thing about Doug is that I really wanted to cast leading men that were really good looking, and that sounds a bit like like obvious, but like, I kind of feel like in Britain, leading men aren't. Leading men aren't cast for being good looking. They're kind of like, it's almost shunned away from in this country. Mm. It's almost difficult to get a big role if you're too good looking, yes. Because, you know, people think that you should be in romantic comedies or you should, you know, I don't know. We just seem to shy away from it. So I was really keen that like people for the poster, for those parts would be really good looking, and you try and do it a little bit more like it's done in America, you know?
Mm.
So I thought Doug had a great face, would look great on a poster, would be a perfect leading man. And I also thought that when I wrote the part, he looked almost identical, really, to the person that I, you know, that I kind of had in my mind. So when he walked in, it was a complete gift, and I couldn't believe he hadn't done more. So I'm amazed. I'm surprised, and I hope that this will sort of project him on to do more stuff. But
yeah, no, me too. Yeah. I mean, I think because given the role, you know, given the role of that, he's the epitome of someone that has escaped the life for 20 years, and he's become a success, and so on and so forth. You needed someone that can look like a success story.
Well, I love that little bit about Doug.
I was saying with Doug, what you've got is a character who needs to convey success when you look at him, because he's someone that's left behind alive, and therefore he needs to look like success in himself. And I think that's what he carries off as well. So those moments when he's walking through the office and he's got the authority to talk to the people who are dicking about and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know,
if he'd have just been in like a knuckle dragging thug, it wouldn't have worked, would it?
No, I think he had to be able to cross over in society. And to do that, yeah, as you say, he had to look a certain way and act a certain way and hold himself a certain way. And he naturally had all of that. So, yeah, it was a real bonus finding him. I felt like it was a real find. And I'd be really excited for him to sort of kick on from here and do some really big stuff.
And what was interesting is a kind of complexity to his character, especially I think it's the scene when he's going in because his son's gone beginning to take a violent path himself, and him and his wife go to see the teacher. And it's the wife that's chomping at the bit, wanting to sort of do kind of rough justice, as opposed to him.
Yeah, sorry. Say that one more time. Sorry.
I was saying that the scene where he goes to see the teacher about his son with his wife.
Yeah. Oh, well, and she's what? Yeah.
She's the one that's chomping at the bit, thinking, "Let's deck this teacher. Who the hell is he to talk about my son like that?" Whereas, obviously, Doug's character is sort of going, we don't hit people anymore, so let's just see what we need to do to fix this.
Yeah, exactly. And I also think that I wanted to have the fact that he had a woman in his life that was, you know, sometimes you meet these people, and I know it sounds ridiculous, but like some of their wives, and the right wife, some of, you know, my friends who have wives sometimes can get wound up by their wife, you know, they won't want to engage in a certain situation because they don't want to get wound up, and their wives are sort of almost urge them on to get wound up about it. So I kind of like that idea that she was getting wound up because he wasn't, you know, and as you say, yeah, he was just trying to hold it down and realize that he was in a different sphere and a different part of his life, and very much like he doesn't need to get involved and angry. And even when he explodes with his son at the table, it's like it's that kind of dormant beast that he's been desperately trying to keep away from the forefront of his life. Because, you know, for whatever reason he left, he's kind of been able to get rid of that. So yeah, it was just a nice kind of touch that the wife would be absolutely fuming and he would be staving that off.
Now, Cass Pennant's one of the co-producers on the film.
Yeah.
And what involvement did he have in terms of the story? Obviously, given the scene in the football stadium and stuff, I can imagine that.
Yeah, well, I think that Cass was very helpful to sort of help with the kind of authenticity of like the character, those kinds of people, like Doug's character, and those kind of character traits would be like, and just whether he was sort of being a convincing performance in about how. You know, how he would behave, I suppose. I think that the film kind of went quite far away from the football hooligan, but it started in that sphere, and we very much wanted to deliver a film for that market, because those guys love going to the cinema and they love buying DVDs and they're very into movies. And so we wanted to make a film that played to that genre, and kept that core audience happy, but also transcended that and went elsewhere. But Kaz was a vital part in making sure that we could deliver on that, really.
Okay. Now the film's already out, isn't it, at the cinemas?
Yeah, it's just going into its second week this week.
Yes, and as far as I can tell, is the DVD is slated for release at the end of the year, isn't it?
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah.
Okay. If you don't already subscribe to Britflix, just sign up for free at iTunes and you'll get the next episode right after we launch it. Or follow at Britflix on Twitter for links to the podcast to stream from the website directly. Thank you. Right then, one last question for you then. Can you recommend me a British film that you feel is grossly underrated and deserves a bit more kudos?
Well, you'll be surprised because it's in comedy. It's in romance and comedy.
Go on.
But I went to see a film called I Give It a Year, which I think did very well, but isn't necessarily... I thought it was absolutely hilarious. It's directed by Dan Mazer, who's the guy that produced all the stuff with Sacha Baron Cohen.
Okay.
And it starred a guy called Rafe Spall, who I'm a big fan of as an actor. Stephen Merchant's in it as well. It's called I Give It a Year. It came out in 2013. I thought it was really, really, really funny. I went to cinema and was pretty much laughing the whole way through. And I've just checked on IMDb. It's got 5.8 out of 10. And I think film than that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Well, look, so, like I say, the film's out now and the DVD's out towards the end of the year. Thank you very much, Gabe.
No, thank you so much. And thanks for all the support from Britflix. I mean, like, British films that are low budget really need it. And thank you so much for doing that.
It's the Britflix.com podcast.
The $99 Cedar Point Gold Pass is back for a limited time. Get unlimited visits for the rest of this year and all of 2025, including unlimited hollow weekends and free parking. Don't wait, because the price goes up on September 3rd. Get your 2025 Gold Pass and start planning your visit at cedarpoint.com.